Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Later in the hour, WFAE's executive editor Eli Portillo speaks with Michael Graff. He is the founder of the column The Charlotte Optimist. But first, we turn to my conversation with North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson. Since taking office, Jeff Jackson has been involved in opioid crisis litigation, cracking down on scams, working on housing cost reforms, targeting fentanyl trafficking and money laundering, and positioning our state at the center of efforts to curb corporate consolidation and initiating aggressive consumer protections. Those efforts span several industries, from pharmaceuticals to concert ticket prices to corporate mergers that might diminish consumer choice while increasing costs. We could spend hours with Jeff Jackson talking about these and other efforts, but we only have a couple of minutes, so let's make the best of our time. Jeff Jackson, thank you for joining us.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Since your days in Congress, you've been known to taking to social media to explain things to citizens and to keep them in touch with what you've been doing, first as a congressman, now as attorney general. I'm just curious, what kind of response have you gotten to that approach?
I've gotten a good response. It does vary based on the type of social media platform that you're using. So I'm pretty widespread. I'll post to 7 or 8 different social media platforms, just trying to reach as many people as possible. But over time, you do get a sense of what type of audience you're reaching on, say, Instagram versus Facebook versus Reddit versus Twitter. So reading the comments is always an interesting experience. But when I walk around in the real world, and when I'm at Food Lion, when people come up to me, it's because they've seen me on one of those platforms and they say, hey, I appreciate the effort that you make to just let me know what you're working on.
So let's talk about one of the things that might be really well explained on one of those platforms, and you can use our platform to explain it because a lot of people aren't following this and have no idea that it might impact them, and that is the merger of Nexstar and Tegna. Nexstar wants to buy one of its biggest competitors. These are broadcasters, which you say could end up costing viewers more money. And you say this is exactly why antitrust laws exist, and I'm, meaning you, going to court to stop it. First, explain how this merger could cost us more money.
Well, it could cost us more money because the CFO for Nexstar said that was the plan, that post-merger, they were going to, one, raise prices, and two, lay off a bunch of local reporters. So when you combine that with the fact that this merger is fundamentally against the law, then it's obviously a bad idea, and we should take them to court. It's against the law because there are clear, long-standing federal rules about how much media consolidation is allowed to take place in this country, and this blows through all of those limits. It's not remotely a close call. To your point, Nexstar and Tegna are not household names, but the fact is Nexstar is the largest TV company in the country. They have over 200 stations. Tegna's third. The two of them combined would be by far the largest. And the bottom line here is this could impact 80% of American households. So it's going to reduce the overall quality of the news that you have because there are going to be fewer reporters doing it. It's going to raise prices, and it's against the law. It's not really a close call from my standpoint as to AG as to whether this deserves to be a priority.
So many questions. If it's against the law, why isn't this being stopped at the federal level?
That is an excellent question. And here's exactly what happened. We filed our lawsuit. Within 24 hours, US DOJ had ended their investigation into this matter. And even more oddly, the FCC waived its own rules to approve this. Within 24 hours. So clearly what happened was Nexstar hit the gas, went to the feds and said, we need you to sign off on this immediately because we cannot afford this lawsuit actually being heard. They've got an argument. We cannot let a judge hear this. The play is get your approval and then we declare victory and then tell the court they no longer have jurisdiction over this, which is exactly what they did. So we filed an emergency motion. We said, hey, judge, they're trying to get around you, which is a pretty good reason why you shouldn't let them. So we said, hey, please freeze this merger in place just to let you hear our case. And the judge said yes.
So let's get back to why it would cost us more money. The Nexstar and Tegna would combine. They would become the biggest operator of television stations in the country. And we'll talk about what that impact would be in North Carolina in a moment. But how would that affect prices? How will that affect what we pay? We don't pay anything unless you have cable.
Well, that's true. I mean, unless you have cable, they've told people that they're going to charge more. A lot of this business is basically resale business. So the local reporters, local stations are going to go out and capture news. And then there are lots of sale packages to different companies that allow them to rebroadcast. And they've made very clear they're going to increase those prices.
So when you see these periodic signs on television, on cable systems, that you've lost a channel temporarily while they're in negotiations, that's what they're negotiating about, what the retransmission fee. So if you own three or four or five stations in a market, five of them could go dark.
That's exactly right. And that's the essence of these antitrust matters, is when you are gobbling up one of your competitors, particularly in the same region, which is the case in Charlotte and is the case in the Triangle. Well, now they've got a ton of leverage over you as a consumer, and you don't necessarily see that directly, but you're going to feel it when you pay a bill or for those blackout periods. North Carolina is going to be a top three state in the nation impacted by this if it goes through.
When you think about it in your mind, which is worse, the potential for customers paying more as the result of this merger of mega station owners, or the lack of editorial choice, the combining of editorial forces and diminishing the number of reporters and voices heard?
I think it's probably the latter. And it's not just editorial control and sort of editorial monolith that you see post-merger in these situations. It's just a decrease in the total number of local reporters, I think, is particularly bad. Whether or not you're a regular watcher of local news, you benefit from these reporters being your eyes and ears at school board meetings, or if you get a complaint from a small business. There are all types of things that they are applying scrutiny to on your behalf, and you like that, and you benefit from that. Less of that is bad for all of us.
The merger here would impact the Charlotte market, where Nexstar already owns WJZY, which is home to Queen City News and the Fox television network, not Fox News, but the Fox Entertainment Network. And Tegna owns WCNC, which is the NBC affiliate in town. If past is prologue, as you have said, they reduce staff in their news departments. Is that because past is prologue, you've seen them do this in other markets? Or have they said, when we come in, we are going to maybe combine newsrooms?
Past is prologue because we have seen them do this exact thing in other markets. I believe it was Indiana, where they took two newsrooms and basically made them one newsroom. They preserved dual branding, but in every other respect, one newsroom. But also because the CFO has made statements that we're not as explicit as, hey, we're going to lay people off, but we're about, hey, we're going to find a bunch of synergies. Here's how much we think those synergies are going to be worth, in excess of $100 million. And within that context in which he was speaking, pretty clear we know where that money is coming from, where those savings are coming from. Those are layoffs of local reporters.
So this would affect two stations in the Charlotte market, but it would also impact Greensboro, High Point, Winston-Salem, and the Norfolk Newport News area, which includes eight North Carolina counties. It would affect NBC, Fox, and the ABC affiliates. And if this merger is concluded, Nexstar would control 265 television stations across 44 states and Washington, D.C., making it the largest local broadcast station owner in history. It used to be, when I got into this business, no single owner could own more than seven television stations. How did we get here, and what has the result been?
I think we've seen a general consolidation in lots of different industries. I think we have seen, over the last few years, consolidation in this space, obviously. Nexstar is not a household name. Tegna is not a household name. For a lot of people, Sinclair is now a household name. I think people who watch this space have seen what has happened with the Sinclair consolidation and how, from an editorial standpoint and a content standpoint, it's become much more monolithic. They don't like that. And they don't like the prospect of us moving more in that direction with other ownership.
Clearly, there have been benefits to station owners and operators. Have there been any benefits to these consolidations of broadcast facilities to viewers and listeners?
Well, let me make the argument on their behalf. I think the argument on their behalf is going to be something along the lines of, hey, the digital revolution has put us under a tremendous amount of pressure. It's put a real squeeze on our profit margins. And this is about us getting with the times and facing these new competitive pressures. I'm sympathetic to that. I completely understand local news, like local newspapers, are under a lot of competitive pressure from people switching their news diet up. But this is simply a case of an industry saying, hey, we're under pressure. Well, I am sympathetic to that. But short of you saying, hey, we're about to go bankrupt, then we're probably not willing to overlook the fact that you want to raise prices while decreasing quality, and violate federal law all at the same time. So while I am sort of sympathetic to the industry saying, hey, we have to grow and change, that doesn't necessarily excuse this particular conduct.
You are not alone in this lawsuit. You joined forces with attorneys general from California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, New York, Oregon, and Virginia to stop this. Where does this stand at this moment, and how confident are you about your success?
Well, because we prevailed in our emergency motion, where we basically told the judge, hey, they're trying to get one past you, they're trying to declare victory and say the clock's run out, we are basically on a trial schedule at this point. We are set for trial. Now, there are a lot of things, because these antitrust cases are so big, that happened between now and an actual jury trial. The Ticketmaster case, which we just won a couple weeks ago, that was sort of on track for trial for about 2 years before the trial actually occurred, because there's just a lot of evidence that needs to be gathered. They're going to say, hey, we have to do this for business reasons. We're going to say, well, this is violating the law, and maybe you don't have to do it. So this is not pending resolution this month or next month, just to set expectations. But at least now we have the opportunity to make an argument to the court.
I want to talk about the Ticketmaster victory that you recently had, because that affects a lot of people too. But it seems to me that Ticketmaster, this Nexstar Tegna merger, and some of the other lawsuits that you and other attorneys general have been involved in, this seems unusual. Is it for state attorneys general to be involved in these things? Wouldn't this normally be handled by the Justice Department in Washington?
The answer is yes, because the Justice Department has the biggest jurisdiction and by far more resources than any AG. But classical consumer protection for attorneys general meant focusing on ways that you were directly getting ripped off, right? Some price gouging from a local business. In Raleigh, we have an issue of a wedding photographer who did not give photos over to a lot of brides. And so that's a direct consumer protection issue. We had a case with the man who bought a can of pork and beans. And he said, hey, it had beans, but no pork. And he even sent the label in and he highlighted where it said pork. And so I called up the company and I was like, hey, I think you owe this man a can of pork and beans. And they sent it to him. That's classical consumer protection for an attorney general. But these days, frankly, because USDOJ has really stepped out of the space, what consumer protection now means is including a lot of antitrust stuff.
More of my conversation with North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson after this quick break. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and here is the rest of my conversation with North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson.
Frankly, because USDOJ has really stepped out of the space, what consumer protection now means is including a lot of antitrust stuff. So just in our office, we have antitrust cases with respect to prescription drugs and the news you watch, as we just discussed, how the internet treats you when you search for things. It's a big Google case. How much meat costs at the grocery store? We're involved in that case right now. How much you pay in rent? We had a big case against the six biggest landlords in North Carolina controlling rent for 1/3 of the apartments in Charlotte and the Triangle. So this is all stuff that hasn't typically been the purview of attorneys general, but now very much has to be. And Ticketmaster is the perfect example, where we had US DOJ as the lead partner in this case until 1 week into trial. Keep in mind, it was 2 years of preparation. And then 1 week into trial, they bail on us, having cut a secret deal that was really a sweetheart deal with Ticketmaster, never telling any of us that they were even considering doing this, and then giving us a 24-hour ultimatum to sign on to their deal. The vast majority of us said no. We had to scramble and pool our resources to continue the trial. And it was a bit of a gamble because we didn't, you know, want to lose a trial having rejected this deal that US DOJ got. But we didn't lose. We won on all counts. We won unanimously. It turned out to be the right thing to do.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but why is this happening? Why are you and other attorneys general having to involve yourself in this? Is this simply a change of policy or position from administration to administration, or is something else at work?
Well, some of this is opaque and sort of lends itself to speculation, but something that I wouldn't say is that this is simple partisanship. That's not the case. To your point, on our Nexstar case, that's a bipartisan case. Ticketmaster, that's a bipartisan case. We have other antitrust matters that are bipartisan as well. There are clear voices in both parties that are just looking out for consumers here. I think this is particular to this US DOJ and the political pressure that it's under.
Meanwhile, you did recently win this case with, that you and 33 other attorneys general filed against Live Nation and Ticketmaster for illegally monopolizing the ticketing and large amphitheater markets for live entertainment events. What brought this to your attention? Why?
This was a case initiated by my predecessor, Josh Stein. I think maybe you remember the Taylor Swift debacle with Ticketmaster, and was initiated roughly around that time. But there had been longstanding complaints by consumers, basically that if you buy a ticket, you put it in your cart and say it costs $120. By the time you go to check out, well, now it's $160. And what's up with that? And there are a lot of, like I said, direct consumer actions that we take where you know exactly how you're getting ripped off. That category, you don't know how you're getting ripped off, but you know that you are. So that spawned an investigation that lasted a very long time. And the evidence that we got during that investigation is that they knew exactly what they were doing, and that their merger with Live Nation put essentially one entity in control of the three main levers of live entertainment: promotion, ticketing, and venue. If you control all three of those levers, you have enormous amount of control over artists and consumers, and you can engage in all types of retribution. You can say to an artist, hey, either perform at these venues or we're not going to sell your tickets. And then you can turn around to the venues and say, hey, accept these performers and don't accept the ones who aren't using our promotion services, or you don't get any of our performers. And that was the nature of our evidence that the jury found ultimately very persuasive.
And you won the case. What will it mean for people who are buying tickets now to these events? Are we talking about big savings of money, more access to tickets, fewer people buying up big blocks of tickets and then selling in the, on the black market? What will it mean for consumers?
The next step is the judge determining what the sanction and remedy is here. I've got some arguments that I'm going to make. Some other AGs have some arguments. We're going to try and, to the extent possible, make an argument with one voice to the judge. That would put us all in the strongest possible position. But what I can tell you is we are asking for major sanctions and remedies here. We are asking for divestment of the two. This was not the first time that Ticketmaster and Live Nation, frankly, had been called out for engaging in unlawful monopolistic behavior. They had been given multiple chances here. What we're saying is you just cannot allow one company to control all three of the levers in the entertainment industry. Clearly, they have abused that.
You've also reached a $17.85 million settlement of generic drug price fixing by two companies, Bausch Health and Lannett Company, and recently filed a new lawsuit against Novartis and Sandoz for a similar practice. Does the fact that you won the first suit, is that going to help you win the second?
I don't know. I won't be quite that confident because the landscape is bigger than that first suit and then the second. The truth is, we're involved in litigation against dozens of prescription drug manufacturers for price fixing. Again, here, the evidence that we got through the investigation is very strong. I think we had a couple of people early on who realized, hey, we probably just need to pay the bill here and accept accountability. We've got a lot of folks who aren't prepared to do that yet. So we're on a course for trial with them.
And finally, the North Carolina Senate voted to ban you from suing Donald Trump or challenging his executive orders, either individually or in conjunction with other attorneys general. That bill was introduced in mid-April. It has yet to pass through the House. Do you think ultimately it will pass with the legislature able to override any veto that Governor Stein might put on it? What's at stake here if you can't do this?
The reason why I think it's unlikely for it to pass is that we have demonstrated pretty good track record with the cases that we have brought. If you add up the tax money that we have protected for North Carolinians, it's right at about $1.6 billion at this point. It was $230 million for healthcare, $165 million for public education, $200 million from FEMA, and the list just goes on and on. It adds up to about, you know, the equivalent of 5% of the state budget. I just can't imagine these guys with the fiscal pressure that they're under saying, actually, we would be content to let all that money go. I think they've seen we've been selective and effective at how we use our power, and that may have changed their calculus a little bit on this issue.
Clearly, you have been very busy, and that's probably why it's been so difficult to get you on our program. But thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time. Attorney General Jeff Jackson, thanks for being here.
You got it. See you soon.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
And I'm Eli Portillo. There's plenty of bad news on the air, online, and in print these days. Between wars, climate change, crime, and chaos, it's enough to make you downright despondent some days. There's even a vocabulary that's emerged around these feelings. News fatigue, news avoidance. It's an issue that we see with national news and local news. But my guest now has a different take on things and a new media venture that's just turned a year old. In fact, he's put his different spin right in the name, The Charlotte Optimist. Michael Graff is the editor and founder. He's been in the media business for 25 years, working for various publications like Axios, The Charlotte Agenda, and The Charlotte Magazine. He joins us now. Michael, thanks for being here.
Wonderful to be here. I'm so excited to talk to you again, Eli.
So we've worked together some before on different stories and things at Charlotte Magazine, places like Axios. Tell me how you got here. What's your road to starting The Charlotte Optimist?
It's a long road. You get in your 40s and you think, like, wow, I forgot about that step. I forgot about those 4 years I spent in Rocky Mount or whatever. No, it was actually a year in Rocky Mount. Of the 4 years I spent in Fayetteville.
It felt like four.
Yeah. I graduated from college in 2001 and had a traditional newspaper path ahead of me. I thought I was going to go to a small town newspaper, go to a slightly bigger newspaper, and go to a slightly bigger newspaper and be a Washington Post columnist covering the Orioles is what my end goal was. Huge baseball fan, and that was why I became a journalist in the first place, was just to go to games for free. The ladder for all of us journalists who came out in the 2000s sort of cracked and broke, and we all had to kind of, I think we're one of the most resourceful generations of journalists because we've all figured out different ways to keep doing what we do. And so I got into magazines and started to work for Our State and became a senior editor there. And then an opportunity came to lead Charlotte Magazine in 2013, and I became the editor of Charlotte Magazine. Did that for a few years. And in 2017, I knew my father was in poor health, passing away, and so I wanted to spend some time with him and went out on my own and did some freelance work for national publications to make a living so that I could sort of live there half-time and help with my dad. A week after he passed, Ted Williams, the founder of Charlotte Agenda, called me, as Ted does. Ted's not a slow mover, and he called me and said, why don't we work together? And I was in a moment of, I was in a moment where I was like, okay, sure. He called me in a moment of vulnerability. And so I decided, yeah, let's go there and do that. And it was a wonderful adventure because it really helped me understand what digital media was and what digital media was becoming. And then the Charlotte Agenda was sold to Axios in December of 2020. And then I got to see how a major newsroom works. And it was sort of a startup culture still at Axios at the time. We were growing like crazy. We were launching new local outlets all over the country. They asked me to lead their Southern Bureau. And so I became the manager and editor of teams from Richmond to Northwest Arkansas to New Orleans, and would spend my days helping them figure out what their top news story was of the day, and really just sort of being there as kind of a voice of reason for them. And because there were, you know, any day if you manage seven cities, there's some bad news somewhere. And in January 1st, 2025, I woke up to a call from our New Orleans team, and that was the day of the terrorist attack on Bourbon Street.
I remember that.
And it was 7:30 in the morning on New Year's Day, and I was there for my team the whole day, and I realized what a toll it was taking on me. I have two young kids. They were, I guess, 3 and 1 at the time. And I was not a happy person on New Year's Day that day. I was sort of, you know, it was another day of dealing with death. It was another day of dealing with destruction. And I just sort of wondered, like, is this the life I want to pursue forever? I loved my team. I loved Axios. I loved the management there. It was a great operation. They treated people very well, treated me very well, and I had a great future there. But I had already been having conversations about the possibility of going out on my own, and that was really the day I was like, okay, this is it. We're going forward with this.
So tell me about the name and the genesis of the Charlotte Optimist, because I think that implies, one, maybe that other media, other people, maybe like us even, are pessimists.
No.
But why the Charlotte Optimist? How did you settle on that?
I threw out a bunch of names, you know, Charlotte Journal. I was just writing a bunch of names down on the paper, and I kept coming back to that one. And at one point in the process of thinking about doing this, I was introduced to a couple of folks in national media, and one of them was Ben Smith, who runs Semaphore. And we sat down, we had lunch one time, and when I mentioned that name, he was like, oh, I like that. And that was the reaction, and I was like, oh, okay. So whenever I would throw out that name, the reaction would be, oh. And I said, okay, that's interesting. I did not realize how much people would latch on to that. You know, the Optimist was it's been a newspaper name in the past. It's, you know, it's been a student newspaper name, I think, in Indiana. You know, it's not like the Optimist hasn't been a newspaper name where people have reported bad news. So I didn't, I never thought that it was going to be a purely, you know, daisies and sunshine publication. That's not really what I am, but I do think optimism is something worth fighting for. And I also believe that acts of journalism are acts of optimism anyway. I think that the work we do, even sometimes when you're reporting tough stories like WFAE does all the time and breaks tough news, and you can think that those stories are downers, but the point is to bring them to life so that brighter days might be ahead, to help people understand what's actually happening. And so I, especially at the local level, I think acts of journalism are optimism.
So I was reading the most recent summary you had of your first year, 180,000 words you've published, 50 newsletters at the time of this recording, I believe. So you basically have written 2 books maybe about Charlotte so far in this year. You do deep dive, long form, deeply reported stories about and with people. Who stands out to you that you've written about, spent time with in this first year, and tell me why?
They all stand out in different ways, you know. I always go back to the one interview. I didn't know Laura Vinroot Poole, and she runs Capital. She's a major, Capital, it's a shop in South Park. She's a major player in the worldwide fashion industry. I have, you know, like 6 pairs of jeans and, you know, some button downs, and that's what I wear. I don't know anything about fashion, but a friend said you should meet her. I did, and I was startled by how grounded she was, like, you know, and I was amazed by that. So that story stands out to me because it was another one of those wonderful moments where I went in to meet somebody that I thought I had some like preconceived notions like, oh, this is not going to, you know, we're not going to connect. And we connected really well. Like we were just talking about Charlotte and she told me about her stories of growing up here and her stories of her grandparents here. And it was, she's so grounded and earthbound that that really stood out. You know, 4 weeks into the job, I mentioned to last year, 4 weeks into launching The Optimist, the police chief, Johnny Jennings, was under a lot of scrutiny for for the buyout, whatever you want to call it, the $305,000. And he was all in the news, and I felt like nobody understood really what was happening because he wasn't speaking. So I just sort of said, if he ever wants to talk, let me know. And next thing I knew, they were like, he does want to talk. And I said, I laid the ground rules for that. You know, I said, CMPD wanted to record that, I said, you can record it, but only if you don't edit any of it. Like, it all has to be recorded. It was very, you know, I set up all the ground rules for it, and they agreed to them. So I sat down with him and did the interview, and that was our first sort of major exclusive. And the biggest thing I felt bad about was that it came out on Memorial Day Sunday, and I was getting texts from news people around town who'd covered that story far more than I had, and I felt bad about ruining people's Memorial Day Sunday, but it was kind of, I didn't have a choice as to when it was publishing, so.
Well, there are worse things in the world. We need to take a short break. I'm Eli Portillo, and this is Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eli Portillo. My guest today is the founder of the Charlotte Optimist, Michael Graff. His weekly column just celebrated 1 year of publication. There's been plenty written about the decline of attention spans, short form video, TikTok, Twitter, how it's sucked away people's ability to really sit with anything. And as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at my phone and twitching, trying to keep myself from waking the screen up. So I certainly feel that in my own mind. You're going against that grain. Why? And what makes you think, what made you think that there is an appetite for the kind of longer, deeper stories that you're doing?
That is a great question. I appreciate it because I always believe that we should zig when everybody else zags. And that's, you know, what I'm trying to do is build a career in journalism, and we all have to adapt and figure out things. And so my hypothesis last year was that everybody was going shorter. I worked at Axios, which was fixed on smart brevity and as short as possible. And I actually believe it's a wonderful way to tell news. But I didn't think that I was personally being served as a reader in Charlotte, by everybody going shorter. It's like, I've lived here 13 years. I know this story better than that news bit that was published, you know? And I was like, well, I want to know the real story behind that, or I want to know who that person is on a deeper level. And so it was a hypothesis. It was a jump, and I decided to go against the grain, and it seems to be working so far. I think in the end, what we're kind of fighting for, all of us in local news and local media in general, is a fight for humanity. And we are trying to, we're in a stage where robots are going to be spitting out news to people and are spitting out news to people on as fast as they want it. And what we can provide as local news organizations and local media organizations is, you know, we can wear out the soles on our shoes. We can go ask people questions. We can be human and allow people to show us that they may be different from the perception that other people have of them through through news bits and through whatever the robots will spit out. And we're all more complicated than anything an AI summary will be of us. And I would love to make sure that we are, you know, I didn't expect this. I thought I was just going to tell deeper stories, but in the end, with this tension with AI and everything now, it's like we are actually fighting for kind of humanity as journalists, I think. I write the stories as long as I think they need to be. I try to cut them back as much as possible. And I hope that it fills some void in the city. There are still great writers and great journalists all throughout town. I never want to try to do everything the things that everybody else is doing. I go to major press conferences, I guess, but I don't, if I show up and there's like four or five different media outlets there, I tend to hang back and try to leave maybe, you know, in the middle of it, because I'm like, oh, somebody else has got it. We don't have enough bodies in our city as journalists anymore to all show up to the same things all the time and try to write the same stories and cover the same news. I don't think that's, in the days of competition, you know, it's fun to have competition, but I just kind of think it doesn't serve the public as well. So I've really, in the past year, looked at what WFAE does, looked at what The Observer does, looked at what the Charlotte Ledger does, looked at what Glenn does with Q City Metro. I've looked at all of these outlets and I've said, you know, they're doing a wonderful job. Where do I fit in? How can I help complement them in some way? I don't ever want to, you know, be the person who's like, oh, I'm just going to try to beat somebody. I'm going to try to create a new version of like The Observer. No, that's not what people want right now. I just want to fill a gap. And to me, I think voicey writing, where I sort of intentionally bring myself to the stories, I'm not really comfortable with first person. It might make people say, yeah, right. But I write a lot of stories in first person because I want people to know that I walk the same streets they do on a daily basis. I drive the same roads they do. I get frustrated about construction like they do. I want people to know that I'm a real human and I'm really their neighbor. And that's what I'm hoping to fill.
So you've profiled and spent time with some figures who court controversy, I think, like Sheriff McFadden, and figures who have found themselves in controversial situations, like the police, former police chief you mentioned. How do you balance humanizing people, giving them a platform to talk? I think it's fair to say with Sheriff McFadden, I remember you wrote at one point he talked for 30 minutes without interruption. So yeah. Certainly a platform. How do you balance that with the need to bring a little bit of the skeptical eye, the journalist's eye, the, you know, you're a friendly person, but yeah, you're not just sitting there to let someone spill to you. How do you keep that in balance?
Yeah, I in the case of Gary McFadden, I really was on a journey to try to understand who he was. I've known him for a long time. He's always been very political, cool, in that he's really nice to me, right? He gave my kid, we ran into each other in the Baltimore airport one time, and he gave my kid a little sheriff's pin. Like, he's very smart and he knows how to connect with people. But there was this other side that was, I was seeing, you know, all these stories of abuse and controversy in his office and things like that. So I wanted to sit down with him and try to understand him and try to see how he would respond to a person who wasn't coming up to him, and the first question, like a lot of news reporters would come up to somebody and their first question will be, what do you think about this? Or whatever, you know, some kind of question about the controversy. I wanted to talk to him about life and everything first. And then I wanted to, maybe an hour, 45 minutes into the conversation, ask him about the hard thing, because I wanted him to be comfortable and I wanted to see how he would respond in a comfortable setting. He responded differently than most people would respond in that setting. Gary's his own person, obviously, but it was a journey to understand him and why he keeps getting elected. You know, it's easy to sit back and say he's got all these controversies, like he shouldn't be elected, and just get mad about it. But like, people are still voting for him. So, you know, I wanted to understand why he was still in power in Charlotte and what that means for our city to have somebody like him in power. And I do that. Yeah. And I, So sometimes, you know, I go through a stretch, and how do I select stories? I'll go through stretches where I do a lot of sort of softer lifestyle, artsy type features and things like that. And then I'll just know in my brain that I need to come back with something that's harder, something that's more topical. So a few weeks ago, I was, you know, coming off one of those stretches, and an interview that I had requested with the Senator Tom Tillis back in February finally came through, and they said, he's going to be in town this weekend. Do you want to talk to him? And I said, yeah. And so that was, you know, it's just, to me, it's kind of just writing about interesting things and sharing my conversations with people. But hopefully there's a balance between, like, you know, hard news, harder hitting type of stories, controversial stories. I got a lot of feedback when I tell a story, obviously, a lot of people saying, why were you so nice to him? Why were you so mean to him? And it's like, I was just letting him talk and listening to him and asking questions as I saw, as the conversation flowed. So
a year into it, how's the first year gone? Are you seeing success? What does that look like?
What does success look like? Yeah, it's more successful than I thought it would be. I had a goal to get to like 5,000 subscribers after a year. It's 6,300 or so. It's not huge, but it matters a lot to people, who read it. And I think I would, you know, I'm at a stage in life, I'm 46 years old, where I'd rather matter a lot to a good, strong core of people than matter a little to 150,000 people. So that's, you know, that's where I am. And yeah, it's going very well. A lot of wonderful conversations. And when people in the news start to contact me and say, you know, I think I want to sit down with you sometime, and they're really thinking about how they want to go about that, I think that's a success too, because I've always said I'm here to listen. Doesn't mean it's going to be all positive, because I can think of one story that wasn't very positive. And the it was detrimental. It was a story I did on the Carolina Farm Trust, a food system story that, you know, I reported on that for 9 months or 8 months or something like that. And I kept listening to the CEO talk to me. And I think he was hopeful that I would write a very positive story. And what I ended up writing wasn't a negative story, but it was a story about how I saw his situation after talking to a bunch of people, and how I saw what he was doing with. And so, yeah, there's...
What was his reaction when he read it?
Never heard from him again. I haven't heard from him again. But I did hear from people in the food industry saying, you know, it sparked a lot of conversation, and I got a reaction from a farmer, a prominent farmer in Charlotte, and she called me and she wrote a rebuttal piece to my piece, and I interviewed her about her rebuttal piece, and it was fun. You know, it's kind of, you know, it was interesting just to continue the conversation.
And that story I remember because I had heard about difficulties with Carolina Farm Trust and, you know, difficulties with the CEO you mentioned, even back when I was a real estate reporter a lifetime ago at the Charlotte Observer. And you mentioned it took 9 months of interviews and reporting and time spent to get that story. When I read that, to me, I was like, oh, that's the kind of story I thought about writing maybe back in the day, but, you know, I never had 9 months to do it. So what's the advantage? Talk to me about the advantage of time and just being able to sit and do something for that long. Because I think that is, in many ways, money is a very important commodity in local media, but I think time has been lost as well as a commodity that's maybe just as important that people don't think about.
That's fascinating that you say that. I think that story in particular is a great example of that, because I didn't know what kind of story it was. It could have been a redemption story. He was trying to raise money to, like, overcome this loss of funding that he'd had. And at the time he first contacted me about doing a story, and first we sat down, you know, I was like, I'll follow you through the process and I'll see if you're able to get through this, over this hump. And he wasn't able to in the end. And so that presented a challenge for me, you know, as the Charlotte Optimist, you know, how do you cover this? And I just sort of let it, you know, be what it was. But I think, you know, that is, I'm not a news reporter. And one of the reasons is that I end up with too many questions, and I end up thinking that this is way more complicated than what my editors at the time or what the publication demands that I do on a daily basis, right? So, like, a lot of times stories are just more complicated than what the Daily News will report. And, you know, I know this is recorded, but just this morning, WFAE was first to the great story, or the interesting story, about the mayor, Vi Lyles, resigning. Terrific journalism work. And I also know how much more complicated that story is than what people will make it in social media or anything like that. They'll say, oh, it's another this or another that. But I also know it's it's a human story too. And it's not just politics all the time. So I think time, you know, I just don't rush to stories. It does present some challenges with making sure I have a newsletter on Sunday.
I was going to say, you do still run a weekly newsletter product.
Right. If you ever see me run a really quick hitter column on something that happened Friday, which I've done two or three times, it's largely because the story that I was working on wasn't quite ready.
And when you think about who's on your dream interview list, you've talked to some big names in Charlotte, some of the biggest names. Who's out there who you haven't talked to who you're like, ah, that's someone I got to get? And maybe they'll hear it and give you a call.
That's funny. There are a couple people that I think I'm very close to getting. It's taken a while. But and so I don't know. I don't want to scare them off. I'll just go ahead and say it out loud. Marcus Jones, the city manager, is a really important character in the city. I think he's fascinating. People don't really know who he is, don't really hear from him much because we have city council members who are, you know, are the public faces of city government. And I think it's interesting that the city manager has so much power in the city. And I would love to get to know who he is and how he does his job.
Yeah, he can be a cipher compared to some of the past folks like Ron Carley, who I think interacted publicly a bit more and were more of that public face in themselves. So I'll be looking forward to reading that when you get him.
I hope so. Yeah, one day.
We're not going to jinx it. So starting year two, what is next? And this is a business, not just a passion project. How do you keep it viable?
Great question. You know, it depends on the community. I've always said the community will tell me whether they want this. I raised money at the beginning to get it off the ground as a nonprofit. That money will take me, you know, it was set up to take me through 18 months. I'm at 12 now, obviously. As I've done more stories, as I've done more Optimist, some other donations have come in, some unexpected donations. You guys live in this world as well. And so I've not done a funding drive or anything like that, but I have enough money now to get through the end of the year, and that's nice. And I just keep hoping the snowball effect happens. I would like to not deal with advertising. I hate to say it that way, but it's like,
it's tough too when you're a one-man band.
Yeah, and I don't want to, and I don't ever want to mix the conversations. And even in fundraising, it was like that, where I'll sit down to lunch with somebody who I know could be a potential donor one day, and I have to decide, you know, before I sit down, is this a conversation about where I'm like doing some background reporting about the city, or is this a conversation where I'm going to ask them for money? And every time so far, 100% of the time so far, I have gone to the help me understand the city. And I think I probably need to get over that going forward. But that's the nature of journalism. There's always going to be either an advertiser, there's always conflicts, you know, and I just happen to be a one man show, and that means all the conflicts are in my head every week, and I try to do the right thing.
Well, I want to thank my guest, Michael Graff, the founder of the Charlotte Optimist, for joining us today, as well as Attorney General Jeff Jackson, who spoke earlier this hour with Charlotte Talks host Mike Collins. In for Mike Collins, I'm Eli Portillo, and this has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.